50 again. Cummings, I just really, really want to give you high praise and thanks for yesterday, because I thought we had a very, very good hearing. The executive department did an excellent job on their presentation. Whether you agree or not agree is not the issue for me, but your professionalism and your willingness to listen came through so much, and I appreciated that immensely. We today, believe it or not, this is the last day on the CAF budget, then we can start anew in terms of other things that are set before us. So I want to ask, today is Thursday, March the 1st, and we're going to be talking about House Bill 5031. Ms. Speaker, was there anything you need to say while I have Ms. Foley and company to join us here?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, just to reiterate, this is the final day of the Children, Adults, and Families budget presentations. Next week, you will have Commission for the Blind, and then you will go into health services, starting with the public health budget. So we'll be changing topics.
Any comments, comments you'd like to make while we're waiting for Ms. Foley to get started? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Foley.
Chair Carter and members of the committee, my name is Ramona Foley. I'm an assistant director of the Department of Human Services with an area called Children, Adults, and Families, CAF. And today is a day that many of you have asked questions about, so we're really excited to be presenting the field services part of the organization. If you were to flip back to page 8 of your document, you would see there the organizational structure for CAF. And you would quickly notice that what we've done now is we've covered the Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs, we've covered the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children, also known as Child Welfare, and we've covered Vocational Rehabilitation Services. Mm-hmm. So today, what we'll be talking about is that section on the left, Field Services, which of course is the largest number of our employees in the department in any particular place, and those 16 district offices that we have the state divided into. And so Jim Neely will be walking us through this part of the organizational chart.
Thank you, Jim. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families Field Services Section. And if you'll flip to page 137, have a map that demonstrates the 16 districts that CAF has within the state of Oregon. We have approximately 100 field offices in those 16 districts combined. And I say approximately, and it's not because I can't count how many offices we have, but rather because on a routine basis, leases are expiring and we're either outgrowing or moving offices closer to where our client population is. So the actual number of offices from month to month changes a little bit as do some of their locations. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. Earlier in the conversation, a question came up, I think maybe from Senator Gordley, about having multiple services within our offices. And if you flip to the next few pages, you'll see literally where our offices are and the particular services within CAF that are available in those offices. I think one of the bigger issues is how many times we actually have our partners available in the offices as well. And that's something that we always strive to do, although it has actually gotten more difficult for us in the last few years. As we've tried to conserve administrative funds, and in fact, last biennium closed several offices around the state in an attempt to do that, we've actually shoehorned more of our staff into a slightly fewer number of offices and ultimately had to ask partners to move out in some cases so that we could do that. We try.
Can I just interrupt you for a moment? I'd like to introduce some members of the 141st Brigade from the military of the National Guard who are visiting with us today, and one just happened to be Staff Sergeant Madonna Davis, who's my daughter, and then Master Sergeant, I can't think of his name. Okay, thank you. They're visiting with us today. They had a day off. My daughter was supposed to go to Afghanistan, but picked up an 80-pound box of ammunition and was not able to go. But I think Sergeant, Master Sergeant Herring did go. And so thank you very much for visiting with us today.
Madam Chair, did you say he actually's gone and come back? I don't quite hear it.
Did Master Sergeant Herring go? Oh, okay. Oh, logistics. So they're the people that get people ready for going there, and that's how she hurt her back, getting ready to go to Afghanistan. Thank you very much for being with us today. Mr. Mayor, question.
So, Madam Chair, from pages 138 through 144, the listing of our offices and indeed where which particular services, child welfare, self-sufficiency, or vocational rehabilitation are available in those offices. And you see in a number of offices we have multiple services available from within CAF. Moving to the historical perspective, prior to the reorganization in 2001, we actually had four separate divisions that had large field structures across the state. It was the Adult and Family Services Division, Services to Children and Families, Vocational Rehabilitation, and Seniors and Persons with Disabilities. And within the reorganization of 2001, the field pieces of all those organizations were separated into another division called Community Human Services, and that lasted from 2001 through 2003. We found during that time that it probably wasn't the best organizational structure in terms of removing the field from the program pieces. So in 2003, we moved the field pieces back together with the program. So the field piece for Seniors and Persons with Disabilities went back to SPD, Vocational Rehabilitation, Self-Sufficiency, and Child Welfare came into CAF. And having had that structure for a few years, I think it is actually a much better structure in terms of the communications that are necessary between the field and program areas. Program summary and target groups at the bottom of page 145, it's these 3,600 plus staff that actually carry out the day-to-day operations of the programs that you've heard about both in self-sufficiency and child welfare for the last couple of weeks, including determining eligibility for Medicaid. Now, you'll hear more about the Medicaid programs from the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, but it's actually CAF field folks that do the majority of eligibility determinations for those programs out in the field.
Just one question. Question, Mr. Neely, while you're at that point. Can you tell us, while you're at this point, in terms of caseloads, do you see an increase or decrease in the field, or are you, do you think it's just kind of a wash of this?
Madam Chair, one of the things that will be distributed shortly will be the caseload forecasts. I think by the end of the presentation today, you'll see those. And in most areas, those have risen over time. What we're seeing, particularly in foster care, we're seeing really for the first time in several years a flattening out and actually in some cases a slight decrease in the caseloads. The temporary assistance to needy family caseload having dropped from around 44,000 to about 18,000 through the 90s and early 2000s has come up slightly and continues to raise slightly, but a very gradual rise. food stamps that rose substantially in the early 2000s is beginning to level off, still rising, but at a much slower pace than earlier.
Thank you.
Moving over to 146, field services outcome measures. Really, the outcome measures that field services delivers on are all the key performance measures and other measurements that you've heard about within the specific program areas that have already talked to you about key performance measures. What we've looked for in the last few years is some way to be able to translate that on a local level to what does this mean to me. And so we've come up with a report that we call our dashboard report, so that district managers and program managers on a monthly basis can see how they're doing across a number of these. And we've tried to keep the number reasonable. We've got 5 child welfare measures and 4 self-sufficiency measures, and you see them there on the bottom of page 146. And it's a system that I think works pretty well for a couple of reasons, in that it allows the district managers to compare how they're doing to how we hope they're doing in some of these areas. It allows them to compare how they're doing against other districts, and hopefully if they're not doing well in a particular measure and another district is, then we have that conversation about how can District 2 do so well, and what do I need to do to match that performance. It's also done another thing for us, which is as we've gotten better about producing this data, and one of the nice things about it is people do pay attention to it, and the district managers are the first to report in if it looks like we've made an error in the data, particularly if they're not doing as well as they thought they'd like to do. And it continues to raise questions for us about some of the things that we hadn't thought about before. For instance, only recently we've been able to do a report that talks about the timeliness of child protection response across the state. And while we thought that would be fairly straightforward, when we first got the report out, it detailed for us an overall timeliness response, but because responses will fall into either a 24-hour response or a 5-day response, we were also able to take a look across the state and see that in some areas, most of the responses were assigned as 24-hour response, and in some areas, most of the responses were assigned as a 5-day response. And that then raised a whole new level of question for us about why this difference in practice. And you've heard a fair amount about differences in practice and how we're trying to standardize these things across the state. And so it really is this kind of data that helps us pinpoint those areas where we're most concerned. And so that's one of the things we're working on. The other nice thing about this data is that in most of these areas, the data is available down to the worker level. So it helps district and program managers and line supervisors determine if there's an issue with a particular branch office, if it's with a particular unit, or perhaps a worker within that unit that needs help or training or whatever it is. So we have enough data available now that I think really for the first time we can get down to that sort of a level.
Question. In talking about coming to a point where you're going to become a little more standard in terms of that one procedure, the thing that concerns me is how is it that in some places you can have a 5-day response versus a place where you have 24-hour response? Profile that a little bit for us.
Madam Chair, frankly, we have the same questions about that. And in fact, I think that's one of the things that Ramona mentioned about the Wayne Holder report that she talked to you about, in that the Holder report suggests you really shouldn't have a category of 5 days, that everything should be immediate. And because we haven't been able to manage that because of staffing, I think it's relegated to those cases where there may have been child abuse, but the perpetrator is incarcerated, for instance, or in some way doesn't have access to the child. But at the same time, it continues to perplex me how we could have such a wide swing from area to area around the state in that.
Chair Carter, one of the things we've done is we are able to pull certain cases and take a look to see is it the interpretation of what requires a 24-hour versus the interpretation of what requires a five-day. So we're able to do that kind of a data pull. And the other thing we believe is the procedure manual that I described that will go out starting the first three chapters will go to the field by March the 20th. I think that's going to help standardize because right now the worker has to go in and look at either the statute or look at a rule. And those are quite complex. They are written more with legal language for attorneys, quite frankly, and the worker still struggles with, well, then how do I interpret what this rule tells me to do? The procedure will say if it is a 24-hour contact, it requires the following, and this is why it would be a 24-hour contact. If it is a five-day contact, this is the category that that describes. So I think having that in their hands is going to be extremely helpful in terms of moving us toward consistency.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, switching over to quality and efficiency improvements. Two things I'd like to mention that unfortunately in our haste we didn't get in the book, but we'll provide some additional information on. Number one, a service known as SpeakRight, something that we used in a previous iteration. It was known as Cyber Secretaries. And this is an internet transcription service, funding of which was provided for us by the emergency board. And it allows workers who are going out in the field and taking notes to literally call into a service. And the service then transcribes those notes and literally sends them back in an email so that they can be cut and pasted into our system. We had a trial of this a couple of years ago and very quickly exhausted our funding for it. It became so popular with the workers as a time-saving device. And so now we're able to bring it back through the end of this biennium, and we're taking a very hard look at it to see if it actually provides enough savings for us and able to enable us to self-fund into the next biennium, and we're hopeful that we can get there. It was a very popular service. It has started up again. We've just finished the first round of training for folks, and they're already starting to use it.
I'm excited about that, especially when you allow your case workers to be able to do more work with people as opposed to spend more time writing up a profiling a case in the office, because some of it has to be awfully frustrating. And so I want to give kudos to Representative Morgan and others who have worked so hard with you on accomplishing these kind of goals.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm excited about it as well, and hopeful that indeed we can demonstrate that it reduces overtime to the extent that it actually will be self-funding for us. The second thing I wanted to mention that didn't make it into the book was our use of video conferencing. We find increasing costs for in-state travel as either we travel out to do training for our field staff or they come together in a location and we send some trainers to that location, or whether they all travel to Salem or Portland. And so in the last couple of biennia, we have invested in video conferencing equipment across the state. And while it's not the ideal equipment for all types of training, particularly for the rural areas, it has saved us a tremendous amount of travel time and expense. And overall, I think it was a very good investment to make. And I think we'll, if it hasn't paid for itself already, it will soon, as it's very good technology.
Sorry.
Representative Dickinson, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned it has saved travel time and expense. I certainly understand the dollars and cents part of travel, but could you say just a few more words about saving travel time? I can imagine when you're traveling at a distance, you may lose a day on the front end and a day on the back end for return. How much additional time does this translate to for people to do the actual work of the agency as opposed to just being in a vehicle, for example?
Madam Chair, Representative Nicholson, we did some very early work to try and quantify the savings, and because it looked like it would be so cost-effective, we went ahead with it. I don't know that we've done particular time studies since then, but just as a for instance, folks who are traveling from our Ontario branch coming to Salem, they'll spend a day in transit coming to Salem. They'll overnight, they'll do training. If it's a one-day training, they'll do training that day. Or if it's a half-day training, they'll do a training that day, and then probably overnight again, and then a day returning. And so for what might be a half-day training, they've invested 3 days, as opposed to with the video conference site in the branch office, they can invest the half day in training, and the travel time is saved, and that occurs all over the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Two other issues I want to talk about: staffing studies and self-sufficiency. As a result of a budget note by the 2003 legislature, and a number of members of this panel will recall that, we began our staffing studies, and our phase one staffing study conducted in 03-05 was primarily focused on eligibility driven programs. And the idea with the staffing study was twofold. Number one, to try and get an idea of whether or not we were adequately staffed in these eligibility program areas, but also to be able to develop a vehicle in which we could come back to this and other committees and demonstrate when we had or didn't have increased staffing needs. Because what we've always used before is a caseload measure. And I'm sure as you've heard over time, the work of a particular caseload ebbs or flows based on the program and not necessarily the number of cases that you have. So these studies were designed to move from a caseload standard to a workload standard. And so we did most of the eligibility programs in 03-05, and in phase two did temporary assistance to needy families and primarily the jobs program associated with that, so the case management side of that. Unfortunately, phase two wasn't done in time to incorporate that into our budget building process this time around, but will be for the next biennial budget building. So you will see next time around, rather than caseload measures, although we may also convert them to caseload measures, you'll see specific workload measures. Now, this also requires us to continue to look at the individual programs and on a regular basis reevaluate, is there more or less work in this program, and how many recertifications do we need to do, and continue those measures. But it really is a much more scientific way to approach this. So I'm very hopeful, and indeed we will continue these phases on, I think, until all of our caseloads are covered. For instance, in phase two, we've also worked on vocational rehabilitation, and they have never had a caseload standard before. They just had a set number of counselors out there. So phase two, which again you'll see in the budget building next time around, actually will establish how many counselors they need as opposed to how many counselors they have.
Colleagues, you heard that when we first began this conversation that we were talking about how they were going to rework their performance outcome measures to deal with the issues that they have changed in terms of the request of the last legislature. So my question to you, Mr. Neely, is that will we see these measures reflecting this, the new work that you've done, like with the R department, or the outcomes in terms of what the cyberspace secretary is doing for you, and will that be reflected in those performance objectives?
Madam Chair, the answer is yes. I think, for instance, as and we'll talk about child welfare here in just a moment. SpeakRight also has application on the self-sufficiency side, and that will be one tool that we'll evaluate as we begin its use to see, well, has that actually then saved work on the self-sufficiency side, and what does that do to our need for staffing? So, indeed, tools like that will factor into this.
Thank you.
In the child welfare area, and we've talked some about this already, based on recommendations from the National Resource Center on Child Protective Services, what we call the Holder Report, we enlisted the services of the National Resource Center on Organizational Improvement because one of the issues was how are we using the staff that we have in child welfare to best fill the need. And so we enlisted the NRCOI, the Organizational Improvement Resource Center, to look at that. And in early January of this year, we got their report. The study confirmed that the national standards that were set back in the late 90s probably hadn't at all kept up, again, with the actual workloads in the program, and may represent half the staffing need to do an adequate job in those programs, and that Oregon's staffing didn't even measure up to the national standards that were set back in the 90s. They had recommendations related to four specific groups of staff that we'll talk more about as we get into a policy package. Number one, supervisors, that the span of supervision is currently too large in child welfare to do an adequate job, and there's not enough specific training available for supervisors. It went on to say that supervisors really need to be the experts that workers go to, and that's maybe particularly true in Oregon because we have so many young workers who haven't had a lot of time on the job. So rather than just emulating how you saw somebody else do it, it would be much better to be able to have time with the supervisor to talk about, well, how should I do it? And so training for supervisors and an adequate span of supervision is critical in that arena. Number two, the consultants, education and trainers, or CET positions, as we call them, suggested that CET should be assigned either as supervisors to improve the supervision ratio, and CETs are currently not management staff, or they should be assigned as workers to carry caseloads. About caseworkers, said basically the workloads are too high to ensure adequate case management, and if you can't ensure adequate case management, you can't ensure child safety.
Is that 1 to 12? What's the ratio?
For caseworkers, if you turn the page to the bottom of page 149,
okay.
It really depends on the particular aspect of child welfare that we're talking about. But for instance, for foster care, see the current ratio of 1 to 25 children. National standard is 1 to 15 children. So for the various pieces, there are different suggested workloads. And back to the top of 148, social service assistants. While staff in this category perform very important work, they are doing some of the work that the caseworkers should be doing, and specifically some of the visitation with the families is what they were talking about. So those are the recommendations from the report. As we get into policy option packages, we'll talk about our approach to working with that. A very brief 2007-09 budget summary, you see the couple of pie charts there that show for field services there's about 2% of our administration done centrally, and the rest is program support and field staff, and that's where the money goes in field services. At the top of 149, reductions. Governor's recommended budget has the department administrative expenditures trimmed by $1 million, and CAF share of that is about 0.6 million. Policy option packages, and these are a couple of packages that I expect will generate some discussion. Starting first with 101-2, child welfare safety improvements, and this indeed relates to the discussion we just had about the Holder report and the NRCOI report. You want to talk about that?
Chair Carter, members of the committee, there are three goals, as I mentioned when we did the child welfare testimony last week, to keep in mind as Jim walks us through this package. One is, one of the goals here is we're trying to get to having more case-carrying staff. That is the way we lower the caseloads. And so lowering the caseload is a goal. Second goal is, how do we move the system so that instead of a supervisor-to-worker ratio of 1 to 9.5, we come closer to the national standard that ranges from 1 to 5 to 1 to 7. And so that is another goal within this package. And then the third goal is having consistency in how we do the work. In other words, we move to a practice model where if you have a position, an SSA position, social service assistant in Medford, that position does pretty much similar work to what is done in Corvallis or any other part of the state. And so a consistent model is the third goal that we're trying to get to with this policy improvement package.
Within this package, we really take a two-pronged approach to this. Number one, based on the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvements report, we rearrange some of the staffing that we already have, and then in addition, add some staffing in. The staffing that's added in amounts to 31 FTE for a total cost of $3.8 million total funds, about $1.9 million general fund. And that consists of 6 caseworkers, 21 office specialists, 2s, 3 office managers, and 1 human service specialist. The moving around part of the package reclassifies 66 SSA positions to caseworkers. It abolishes 26 SSA positions to fund the reclassifications. Those are the social services assistants. That leaves about half of the current SSAs in place. It also reclassifies 35 CET positions to caseworkers and reclassifies 29 CET positions to supervisors. And indeed, this was the low-cost approach that we took to this. That effectively eliminates the CET classification entirely, and again leaves about half of the SSAs in place.
So, Ms. Foley, when you look at this workforce, how many CETs are you losing as a result of non-replacement?
Chair Carter, we would lose the total number of CETs, which I believe is about 64 positions. Let me make a comment about CETs. I actually did a little bit of research trying to figure out where that position came from, because it is a unique position in Oregon. Other states don't have something called a CET. They have supervisors and they have caseworkers. And the CET actually grew out of a study that Oregon asked for from a different part of the University of Southern Maine in 1992. Some of you may remember it was presented to an audit, a legislative audit committee at that time. It made a lot of recommendations around what the old CSD should do. One of the recommendations it made was that we needed to have more supervisors. It said supervisors shouldn't supervise more than 1 to 6 workers. It also said supervisors need to have clinical experience. They need to have been caseworkers, or they need to know about clinical practice. Those two recommendations in the report evolved into Oregon's solution to that, and instead of adding supervisors and supervisors who had knowledge of child welfare, it created a new position called a CET. I can tell you it would have been a less expensive position. I don't know if that was a motivator, because I wasn't here then. A lot of us weren't in this business here then. Many of you wouldn't have been. But somehow that choice evolved from that national research project here, and then those positions have continued. And what we found in these more recent studies, those positions are confusing for staff, because staff might go to a CET who is not a manager. They are a caseworker, but they're a higher level caseworker than an SSS1. They might go to that person to get clinical information on a case, only to be told later by the supervisor, no, that is not the answer. That's actually not what we're going to be doing on this case. So it creates some confusion, and the staff themselves in the survey that we did, and about 600 staff members participated in that survey, thought that that's a position that they would like to see, either carrying cases or providing supervision of caseworkers carrying those cases. So again, it's a unique thing in Oregon that that position was created.
That's so good.
Thank you. Mr. Neely and Ms. Foley, I understand from what you're telling us that the approach that you're describing and defining for us is the lowest cost approach, But did you give consideration to other approaches? And if so, what were they? If you could talk about that, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, indeed, we did give other other approaches some thought and discussion. And for instance, if we were to do this without impacting current positions, we determined the price tag instead of $3.8 million would be $21.8 million. That's if we didn't disrupt half of the SSAs and reclassify one way or the other all of the CETs. We looked at, well, what if we just reclassified the CETs and didn't move any of the SSA positions. That would add another $9.5 million total funds to the $3.8 million already. And so in answer to your question, yes, we've looked at those. We were anxious based on what we'd heard in the Holder report and then as well what we got out of the NRCOI and the Southern Maine report to do something that we thought would be at least minimally affordable, and so that's the approach we took.
And if I may follow up, thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Should we understand then that the lowest cost approach, and again, this is with an eye toward improvement, can we say that this is also the best approach? Are you confident in saying that as well?
Senator Gordley, I wish I could say that. I think this is a reasonable approach, but one of the things, of course, that we heard from the University of Southern Maine is that even the standards that we're getting to are old standards, and they've actually recommended that we do a workload study in child welfare so that we can better estimate what the real workload is. And I expect the real workload is probably considerably higher than what we're shooting for here. And if we had no budget constraints and didn't have to reclassify SSAs, one of the things the report was very clear about was that SSAs do valuable work. And you've heard some of that from SSAs during testimony. And indeed, I have absolutely no argument with that. And if we could if we could afford additional support for our caseworkers, I think that makes their work easier and makes them more able to accomplish that work. So I think this is a reasonable approach. I don't necessarily think it's the best approach.
I appreciate the response and the candor in the response. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I echo the thank you and the candor. Because it's hard for me to look at this and not think that we are simply rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic here. And thank you for clarifying. This is the lowest cost approach, maybe not necessarily the best one. I would like to see a summary of the different proposals that you just described to the senator and their costs. It would be helpful for us to see that. I think it's also helpful to educate our fellow colleagues about what we're talking about when we want to have adequate staffing, and it helps us to have numbers. I have several questions. Has there been notification of this staffing change already made? Because I'm hearing that it has not yet been implemented, is my assumption, but has notification been made? What's your timeline on this once approved, if that's going to happen?
Vice Chair Boone and Representative Kotak, we have not moved forward with this. We have put together a work group to include SEIU and representative staff. We have SSA representation on that, along with caseworker representation on that work group. And what we're trying to do is look at this package in detail to see within the box of what the governor's budget allows us, is this the only way of getting to what that box is, the $3.8 million? And we're open to that. We have heard from representative staff that some things are being said in the field. Some folks are being told they need to go ahead and start looking for other employment because these jobs are going away. None of that has been said. None of that has been conveyed to the field. And so one of the things we agreed to do as of a meeting yesterday is we're going to start sending a message out every 2 weeks reminding people that this is a proposal, that this is a policy option package. We have not changed how we do business, and we want to move forward with the conversation, but it's a very open conversation. Again, knowing what the confines are of the size of that budget box, and also at the bottom of 149, we still want to be able to get to these lowered caseloads, the lowered caseloads and the more supervision. And so with those caveats, is there another alternative other than the ones that we've positioned here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm pleased to hear that because I think there is confusion in the field. And, you know, ultimately, we have to make that decision here before anything gets implemented. So I think that message is really helpful. I appreciate the effort to get at the caseloads. As someone who's been following this, I understand the caseloads are an issue. I guess one of my big concerns is we didn't do the staffing study on child welfare. If you look at the appendices that you've given us on some of the summary of improvements, it talks about the staffing study that was done in TANF, and there's a lot of discussion about workload. When I look at this table, I see work responsibilities, and then I see caseload. I'm still not getting a sense that we're really getting the idea of workload. We've got caseload numbers and workload. When we reduce the types of staff that we have, like the SSAs, are we just shifting the workload? Yes, our caseload numbers might look better, but what's the workload? And that's what I'm hearing from folks, that these SSAs are providing very important function. They go away. That shifts to the case managers. I don't necessarily think the workload gets better. The number of cases they're carrying might get less. But can you assure me that we're working on the workload issue as well?
Vice Chair Boone, Representative Kotak, that is a concern. And one of the things I think we are in a position right now is we're almost in a triage position. We have to do something. Our workers are telling us they cannot get this work done. That's what our outcomes are showing. That's what our face-to-face contact reports show us, that the workload is so overwhelming they're not able to do anything. Other states have done workload studies. They take a while, and they cost money. We recently looked at New York State's workload study. It was done by Walter McDonald and Associates, and it cost, I think the price was close to $400,000 for the workload study. Alaska has done a workload study, so we've been paying attention to those states that have done them. I am not convinced that we need to have 50 workload studies in this country, but then I'm not doing those workload studies, and so, you know, I have a little different position on that. I think we can learn from each other, but I do think one of the things we're trying to do here, and it's kind of an interesting dilemma, because what we hear, and we heard the other day in the testimony, is, if you recall, as staff described what it's like to go to court, the worker came out of the courtroom and the parent was really upset with the worker because of what? Because the worker had just acted like an attorney. The worker had taken on the adversarial role in court, and therefore the parent sees that worker not as their person who's going to help them, but somebody who is asking a lot of hard questions and making them feel bad in court. Meanwhile, the SSA steps forward and says, I'm going to arrange visits for you. So then in the study we see the SSA is going to be spending 55% of their time with the family, including the parent and the child, and the caseworker is only going to spend 22% of their time. So we really are trying to turn something around here. It's pretty significant. And it does link to the next package we talk about around legal representation. But the focus of all of this, and there's still going to be the issue of workload, I think if we can make these kinds of changes, we still should go forward and have that workload study done. It makes me nervous to think that we would hesitate and pause and wait for that kind of study, because you have to do an RFP, you have to wait for someone who has expertise in this area, and there are a number of folks out there that are doing this in child welfare, like I said, but that's going to be a period of time into the future before we would have that kind of ability to have that work done.
Hello? Thank you. And thank you. I agree. I don't think we should wait for a study. I guess when I looked at the staffing study we did for TANF, for example, it talks about use of paraprofessionals. In my mind, that's what the SSAs are doing. They're providing that paraprofessional role. We heard very compelling testimony that having more than one person working on a case, an SSA working with a case manager, clearly defining those roles. I mean, I don't think an entire case should be taken over by an SSA. But there is value to having both of those individuals working on a family's situation. So we're going to go to a situation where we're going to go back to one person. That might provide consistency and focus, but I guess I'm not convinced we're providing the best situation for the family. Clearly, there's some more positives to the SSA. So I'm just really struggling to feel that this is going to be a good thing. I would like us to move beyond the low-cost approach. But I think there's some value in what we've been doing with the SSAs. And I'm assuming CETs had a valuable role. They were doing good work. They just weren't sitting on their hands. So we've moved those into case managers. What gets lost? I don't have a good sense of what the trade-offs are here, except we're getting to a better number that could in some ways just be, an illusory idea that we're doing a better job. We might have better numbers, but are we really improving the service?
Vice Chair Boone, and now Chair Carter and Representative Kotek, I appreciate those concerns. And as Jim said, this is not about not valuing the work of the SSA. The SSA is going to still have a role. That's why you don't see the proposal eliminating SSAs. One of the things they are able to do is they're able to provide supervision of some of those visits that the court says there's a safety issue here and this visit has to be supervised. Caseworkers wouldn't have the time to do that kind of intense supervision. On the other hand, when we get ready to go to court, what we have, and you'll see this cited in the actual report, we've had situations where we're going into court and the caseworker now is recommending that the child return home and the SSA is recommending that the child stay in foster care. And we are in there testifying against ourselves. And so while there's value in those second sets of eyes, there's still that responsibility for the case. The department still has to have a position on these cases. And then the work around that should be around the worker being the focal point for that family. The SSA would continue to do valuable work. I would see, for example, one of the changes we'd have is prior to a child returning home, the worker should be supervising some of those visits. They should see firsthand what's happening in the interaction between the child and the family. So as Jim said, it's not that we are wanting to say we no longer need that SSA role. In fact, we're only willing to go halfway on in this package. And again, that's a decision I think has to be discussed. We're getting some good input from SEIU and from SSAs on this. Workers are very worried about it. They don't want to lose that because they see that person as being the person that helps us file with a court order about having frequent visitation between the child and the parent, for example.
Just one last follow-up. And thank you. I appreciate the time we're allowing for this. I think it's really important. I guess it would help me understand reclassifying, because one of the issues that I worry about is we could lose experienced individuals who've been doing this work for many, many years as SSAs. And we all have a retention issue in DHS in terms of retaining people. When you say reclassifying, walk me through that. So someone moves, if they have the expertise, they move to a caseworker. How many people are we losing who have experience who won't make that jump?
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, of the SSAs we have now, approximately 25% of them qualify to be caseworkers. They have made choices not to be caseworkers because the reality is they want to spend more time with children and families. and there would not be an automatic movement of an SSA to a casework position because the casework position has a different set of qualifications in the state system. And Jim, I don't know if we have a figure for how many would be lost totally in this process.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we don't have a figure for how many would be lost, but I think your point is that indeed it's not that we reclassify individuals but reclassify positions, and indeed under collective bargaining rights what that amounts to typically after whatever attrition occurs and we make this move is literally a layoff, and some folks in the meantime would go to other jobs. Some folks would, we call, bump downward into other positions, and some folks would ultimately be laid off, depending on the numbers and how long we took for the attrition strategy to work. But it indeed would likely mean at some point that we lose some experience that we value.
Just really brief. Thank you. That's really helpful. We reclassify the positions. Is your package guaranteeing that they will be filled, or will we just have reclassified positions? I don't know if that question makes sense. If we move, say we have 10 reclassified or whatever the now caseworker positions, does this budget package allow us to fill them at a higher pay rate for caseworkers? Will we refill all these spots as caseworkers?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, for instance, the first bullet there, reclassifying 66 SSA positions to caseworkers. Indeed, the outcome of that, ultimately, whether it's 2 months from now or 12 months from now, is that we would have 66 fewer SSA positions and 66 more casework positions at the casework level.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to follow up on the questions regarding reclassifications and workloads and so forth. I have several. When I look at the proposal, there would be 66 additional caseworkers from reclassifying SSA, 35 additional caseworkers from reclassifying CET, and another 6 additional caseworkers added. So just from this particular proposal, if I'm not missing anything, it looks like we're adding 107 more caseworkers total. So I have a few questions. One is, how would those be spread around the state? They're probably not all going into one region, but there's probably some strategic placement, and it's not just a matter of dividing them up among the regions. And another question is related to how many employees in the department might be interested in those caseworker positions if they're viewed as an opportunity to move up, an opportunity for advancement. Or are there any plans yet for providing or encouraging or appointing individuals to training or certification or whatever it is required to move from jobs that they already have into the caseworker jobs? Is there some assistance plan?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, let me take the easier one first. Indeed, these positions are divided up around the state, but they are divided up based on where the cases are. And in fact, we typically do that 3 or 4 times during the biennium. We'll put a group together to look at Marion Polk Yamhill's caseload may be up, Jackson Josephine may be down, and so vacancies that occur in Jackson Josephine don't get filled there, they get transferred, and the same happens with new positions. We'll look at where the caseloads are, and we do our best to maintain even caseloads around the state in that manner. In terms of opportunities for other staff within the department, we probably will see some of that. And in fact, when we say 25% of the current SSAs would be eligible to be caseworkers, whether or not they might be interested in being caseworkers, that is based on the degree requirement for a caseworker, which is a bachelor's degree. And there may well be other folks within the department that are doing other jobs that would be interested in that, although to be honest, we don't see that very often. For instance, a worker moving from self-sufficiency case management, slightly lower level, into child welfare case management. It happens, but it's not like we have a line of people waiting for that.
Yes. Thank you. Two other questions I have. When I look at the table at the bottom of the page that shows the net result of the actions and looking at the ratios, in all of them it looks like we're going to be matching the national standard, that we will be making improvements to match a national standard where one exists. The only one where I noticed a difference was in adoptions. Instead of a national standard of 1 to 12, what's proposed is 1 to 15. So I'd like to hear just a few words about that. And then the other question is about the proposal to add 21 office specialists twos with technology or procedural streamlining or making things easier and straightening out some things. Can you please explain why the need seems rather great to add 21 office specialists however, lose some of the help that we see from SSAs?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, on the adoptions issue, this was an area, like I mentioned in vocational rehabilitation, where we have not had a standard. We just had a number of workers that were assigned some sessions ago for that. And what we're trying to do here is to make sure that in every category we have a standard. And with adoptions, we were trying to do this with no additional cost, but to establish a standard. What happens, and in fact has happened over the years when we've had, I think, 67 adoption workers, is that we have 67 adoption workers, whether we're doing 500 adoptions a year or 1,000 adoptions a year. And as a consequence, as we do more adoptions, we literally end up borrowing workers from other areas that are already ill afford to donate to that. And so what we're trying to do here is, without adding additional cost immediately, is to at least establish that, based on what we have now, if we're doing more workload or more adoptions, that that's reflected in the standard.
Do we address the adoption? Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, in terms of the adoption, as Jim mentioned, we don't currently have a standard, but you'll notice the difference there. The national standard, they speak of 1 to 12 families, and we have converted that to 1 to 15 children, and it was actually to be consistent with the foster care caseload. We thought that would be reasonable. And the office specialist.
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, on the office specialists and indeed the other staff that you see listed there, that really is in line with the current standard and what we find, and as well what we saw in the NRCOI report was that there are indeed a number of things that can come off of the plate of the case manager onto support staff. And I would include, to some extent, SSAs in that category. And one of the discussions that we had as we were looking at this package was we could put all of the money into additional caseworkers and not add the support staff. Ultimately, I think that leaves caseworkers doing some of the work that really doesn't maximize their effectiveness. So we included them at what is our current standard.
Thank you.
I said, thank you very much. I've been listening intently to the conversation, and going back to something that Ms. Foley said earlier about employees out in the field who are questioning and kind of uncertain about their future as
all of this unfolds. And so as I've been listening and as we've been asking our questions, my question for you is, what would be the message that you would send to employees every other week? And I'm also wondering if every other week is often enough. Should it be a week, given the complexity of what we're talking about here? And if you could respond, please.
Okay. Chair Carter and Senator Gorley, we chose every other week because that's kind of going to follow the meetings of that steering committee. We think there will be activity each of the weeks as we look at possible options, if there are some other ways of posing within that box how to get to those caseloads. Interestingly, my conversations with labor management have been good in that nobody disagrees with those three primary goals. People do believe, our staff in the field do believe, we've got to get lower caseloads. They also believe, and again, remember the study, the survey came from staff themselves, we've got to have more supervision, more clinical supervision in the field, and we need to move to more consistency. And those three things, if we keep people focused on, that's what we're trying to get to. And I think what we've seen is sort of a panic, because anytime you talk then specifically about a position being lost or a group of positions being lost, people tend to then focus on that. But when we pull back and say, here's what we're trying to get to, is there a different way of getting there? Is there a different choice that can be made so that we wouldn't lose the value of any of those SSA positions? There's been more concern, I think, expressed to us around the SSA positions than there has been around the CETs, possibly because many of the CETs not only either qualify as a caseworker, but many will qualify as supervisors or as managers. And so I think that could be a reason. And again, the CET position is something that was created, it looks like, in the early 90s, and so it doesn't have the same longevity with the agency that I understand the SSA position did. Mm-hmm. But we're going to try to communicate as often as we can. If it goes to once a week, that'd be great if we have information. But again, as Representative Kotek points out, they know that this is an evolving process. This is a conversation. People were excited about the fact that you all have shown so much interest in this particular package. I think that's very heartening to staff, that there aren't going to be any abrupt decisions made or abrupt choices, that we don't think through what are all the implications or the ramifications of anything that we do with staff.
And I don't want to even suggest micromanaging your work. Again, I was just curious about how you would craft that message and also who would communicate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Total Committee, Ms. Foley, in terms of the requirements for the SSA, the CETs, and the caseworkers, both in terms of academic as well as work function.
Chair Carter, I'm not going to be able to quote exactly what is on the job description, but the SSA position does not require a degree. It does require some experience in having worked with children and families. And that function, as we've discussed, is more of a paraprofessional function. They are assigned, and they're assigned different ways around the state. But one of their primary functions is they transport children, they transport parents when necessary, to make sure visits are happening. Visits are one of the things that we are required, and also it's a best practice for children in foster care. Usually the court will order visits. They may order visits among siblings, or they may order visits between the parent and the child with some frequency. And so they provide that kind of service. They will also do other kinds of things in the office. For example, if there need to be appointments made, if people need to get bus passes to be able to transport themselves around places, they can perform those kinds of functions. The caseworkers, we went to an increased standard for caseworkers requiring a degree about 5 years ago, and this is pretty standard around the country. And those positions are really, they are the caseworker of record. They're the ones who have the primary responsibility for making sure when that case gets opened that there is a plan in place, that we're complying with all of the state and federal laws, that we are going to court when we're supposed to go to court, we're going to Citizens Review Board when that's appropriate. We have CASAs, and that work has changed so significantly with the adoption of Safe Families Act of 1990. 1997. Remember that prior to that time, children came into foster care and they might stay there for years without a real active plan. Everything changed in the late 90s, and so that worker now is confined by all of those measures you've seen us talk about with the federal standards. They're also confined by court orders. That work has become more and more critical for us. And then the CET, again, was the added person who could do some training, and there's a lot of variation in how the CETs are used around the state. But they might fill in when you've got workers out. They may fill in a little bit behind a supervisor. But there's more flexibility in terms of consulting on difficult cases. In other states, that role is fulfilled by the supervisor. And one of the things we've heard from workers and supervisors is they would really like to have that role really placed in a person, in a supervisor, as opposed to the confusion we sometimes have about who's in charge of a case.
So is the CET required to have a BA degree?
As I recall, Chair Carter, I believe they are, but I do know the majority of them do have degrees. Many of them, some of them have master's degrees. They, at one time, were more likely to be caseworkers and then were elevated to this particular position. Again, they have a broader interest in systems change. They might have a broader interest in working with the court and those kinds of things. A lot of variation across that. The supervisor position does not require a degree. That's one of the things that's pointed out in our report, and it's unusual in that in most states, both the caseworker and the supervisor would be degreed staff. In our state, that classification happens to be broader than just DHS. It goes across a number of other positions. And so we're working with HR and we will work with DAS to try to correct that, because workers now say to us, if I have to have a degree, shouldn't my supervisor also be a degreed individual?
I wanted to bring that out because it seemed to me as if a lot of questions from the committee were coming from, if you're going to be making changes in the department, then will those changes come as a result of the SSA, the CET, and nothing was mentioned about the caseworker. So I was looking at if the academic requirements were different for these two positions, then what could be some of the anticipated problems you would have in the replacement of people if they were to be the ones that would lose their jobs along those lines. So the next question is, do you give opportunity in terms of time and the department for people to go back and become degreed, especially those workers that have been there for some time?
Chair Carter, we can do that, and we have done that in the past. We also have a partnership with Portland State University, as you all are aware, and we have a number of MSWs who come through that partnership. But even at the undergraduate level, we have individuals who come to work with us who have an associate's degree, and then they work themselves, they work their hours and work with their manager in order to go back to school to complete their undergraduate degree because they want to stay in the field, they want to do this kind of work. And so we can make those kinds of things available.
Let me have you, because this is probably going to bring out more questions from the committee, to just go on to page 150 under this legal representation, because committee, you will be having to make some decisions on this issue, and you will be having to make it because there's a difference in thought in terms of these positions, and we allow them to do more social work or more casework while we have bring lawyers on, or you may be required to make some decisions, so I think we want to spend some time on that in these last 15 minutes.
And Chair Carter, if I may, we also have a worker who's joined us today. She was to be here yesterday, but she's joined us today, and she wanted to speak to the committee. And so we're going to try to allow a little bit of time for that as well.
Can I ask for an extra 10 minutes on the part of the membership? Would that be okay? Thank you very much.
Okay. Chair Carter, as you mentioned, on page 150 is the package on legal representation. As you have heard us talk about, we are unique in this state in that we have our workers go to court. They go to court without having benefit of legal representation, not in the court and often not in preparation of going to court. And this is something that I also unearthed in the 1992 study. When I went back and read that, they pointed out that this is really a dilemma because social workers aren't licensed to practice law. And I think one of the things that's exacerbated this particular problem is the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act. Now we're talking about cases that have very stringent timelines from Congress as to how long children can stay in foster care, when do other decisions about those children have to be made. And as you see us and see the performance measures and you're struggling with caseworkers trying to meet those performance measures, we're at a great disadvantage in that we do not have that legal representation across the board. Jim, you want to talk a little bit about the package we did get, and then I can talk about the Attorney General's work group.
In October of 2005, we did get a package to increase legal representation for DHS. We got one supervising attorney, or rather the Department of Justice got one supervising attorney and four attorneys. We received within DHS 20 paralegals and 10 support staff. And that has allowed us to offload at least some of the legal work from the caseworkers onto the paralegals, and has provided more consultation and some more hearings coverage with the AG's office. The package that's proposed actually would add 9 senior assistant attorney generals, 1 supervising attorney, 2 paralegals that would be at the Department of Justice rather than DHS, 3 legal secretaries, and 1 office specialist. So it would be yet another move forward in trying to get coverage for more of our hearings, as well as getting consultation with the AAG at critical marks in the life of a case. And specifically, what we hope to be able to do with this additional cadre of AAGs assigned to DHS from DOJ is look at each case at the 5-month mark and each case at the 11th month mark, typically before go to court hearings.
And the 5-month staffing would prepare the worker for the First Citizens Review Board, which occurs at 6 months. Unless you're in a county where the court holds court at 6 months, Multnomah does that quite often, and therefore they may not have that First Citizens Review Board. 11 months prepares the staff and the case prior to going into court, which is required at the 1-year interval. And then it's required that the court periodically go to review the case after that. So while this doesn't put us in a position of having the worker have a legal counsel with them when they go into court, only in certain cases would that still be allowed. And we have some criteria around those kinds of cases. They're the most sensitive cases of all. But it would require that the worker is sitting down, the worker and supervisor, actually looking at what is the legal sufficiency in this case. Why is this child in foster care? Have we addressed the reasons the child came into care? Is it time to recommend to the court that this child be considered for return to the family? So it would start moving us in a way that the worker would be far more prepared for the kinds of questions that the worker now has to entertain. When the worker goes into court alone, the parent will likely have an attorney there. The child will likely have an attorney there. And the worker is there alone. And so those are the kinds of dilemmas that workers find themselves in. And workers tell us that is, to some extent, one of the most stressful parts of the job, is trying to, they are not allowed to cross-examine witnesses. There are a number of things in the courtroom they're not allowed to do and not supposed to do. But they say it's very stressful to be there with other attorneys, and the other attorneys, of course, know what those rules are.
Senator Gordon?
Thank you very much. We spent a lot of time on this subject last session in the Ways and Means Public Safety Committee, which I had the privilege of chairing. And I am of the opinion now, as I was then, I just want to say this for the record as we continue our conversation, that we need to have integrity in our system. And in those places where we know legal representation should be the standard,
for appropriately and adequately administering justice, because that is also another feature of what we're talking about, the administration of justice in these cases. We need to provide the resources to make that happen. And not to do that means that we are operating without integrity, and that we are also operating in a manner that prohibits access to justice. And in fact, justice may be absent for some of these cases, and that's unacceptable.
The question I wanted to ask. Oh, sorry, Representative Kuchan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification. I want to make sure my numbers are right. So on top of page 151, I'm confused by total funds because it's not jiving with what's next to it. So is it 3.1 in general fund or total funds? And then we talk about 2 million in total funds for DAs and.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, the 3.1 million total funds relates to the particular positions that DOJ would hire, those 9 senior assistant attorney generals and the other staff. There's an additional 2 million total fund in there for agreements with district attorneys. One of the things we've talked about before, though not much today, is that the district attorneys handle a lot of these cases on the front end. Mm-hmm. And as their budgets have begun to shrink over time, that in some counties they've said, well, we really can't afford to do that anymore. And that's problematic because DOJ can't afford to take up that slack either.
I guess, thank you. I just am confused because maybe it's because the numbers are exactly the same, because on page 150 we have 3.1 in general fund and 2.0 in federal funds. And so maybe that's just the numerical issue, but that's why I think I'm confused.
Chair Carter, Representative, I see at the top in that little chart.
Yeah, in the little chart for 101-3.
That's a coincidence.
That's just a coincidence. Okay.
Thank you. That's what the note says.
Okay, that's
very good.
It's all a coincidence.
Okay, good. Thank you. So has the family filed suit against us on the non-representation of a legal counsel in the office as opposed to having a social worker?
Chair Carter, we haven't had that type of suit filed. We do have a lot of tort claims filed and a lot of litigation. One of the things we believe is if we were a system that had this kind of guidance from the day the case is open, mm-hmm. we might actually encounter less of that at the back end of the system. Because often when we get involved and start dealing with a tort claim or a lawsuit, we start digging back, unraveling the case, and we start thinking, wait a minute, here were all the decision points that are missing in terms of what an attorney would have said about this case, or what an attorney would have challenged us to think about, or what we would have been challenged to do. This was clear when we did the sensitive case review this past year. The fact that most of our attorney time has been spent at the deep end of the system when we go to do termination of parental rights, but these are actually the front end of the system.
I think that's a big misgiving, colleagues, because children are not being really represented by legal counsel, but rather by a caseworker. And the big fallback to that is still in my face, Ramona, where a caseworker has to act as a protector, but has to also be the devil's advocate on one end. And that is confusing to children, I would think, and certainly disappointing to parents. When you think that you have somebody who's going to speak in the best interest of your child, and all of a sudden you have professional attorneys on the other side, and a caseworker who's not trained as an attorney has to go in and try to produce the evidence. That's anxiety on the caseworkers as well.
Yes, Chair Carter, it is. And just for clarification, usually the child does have an attorney and the parent has an attorney, and they are there for the interest of that parent and the interest of that child. But what you have is the department there, someone who represents the state, basically, because these are public servants, and there is no representation for that particular piece. And so you have a worker who's being challenged. Usually people are not happy with child welfare cases. There's always at least multiple points of view. And so you have someone challenging the worker to say this child doesn't need to go home or the child needs to go home immediately. And then the worker's trying to defend in their own language against attorneys in the courtroom as to what's in the best interest for a particular child. And of all the work we do in government, I think the Attorney General has been quite eloquent, Hardy Myers, in saying this is an area that really is overlooked, because this is around whether or not parents ever have their children returned to them, whether or not children stay in foster care, whether or not those children are going to have their parental rights severed. All of those decisions are being made, but they're being made in the absence of a critical leg under the stool of child welfare, and that is the legal representation piece.
So, colleagues, you've heard the debate, and it's going to, I want you to carefully study this piece, because as we prepare for our budget, I don't want to take pot shots after the fact. I'd rather try to do something up front. So, how you arm me to go before the co-chairs on this issue is going to make a big difference. So I'd like you to further study and give me your comments either by voice or by written testimony. I would love that input. Mr. Murray?
Is there a question?
Sure.
Chair Carter, I couldn't tell. I was misreading the message.
Oh, a question from the Senator. Senator, did you have
Thankfully, no. She was being very sensitive, you know, reading body language. I looked like I was going to ask a question, but I was not. So. But I'm looking forward to hearing from the individual you have brought.
Yes. Chair Carter, so with your permission, we'll move on now and Chair will introduce the case.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before I invite our worker up, and indeed we were going to have two workers today, one from child welfare and one from self-sufficiency, because we were originally scheduled for yesterday, the one from self-sufficiency had a domestic violence intake that needed to do today, so weren't able to make it, but did send testimony down, and I think that's being distributed to you now. But I'd just like to kind of preface this testimony and make a few observations about the work today. The landscape in Oregon Social Services looks considerably different today than it did when I started as a welfare assistance worker in 1974. While there were some challenges then,
you started off as an assistant worker?
Those challenges in almost every facet of our work are magnified today. There are rural area issues. It used to be that it wasn't difficult to recruit qualified staff in rural areas. That's a big problem today. There are language issues. As of last May, CAF had 640 bilingual workers working for us, and the need grows every day. We have one office in Portland that services clients with 27 different languages. 44 of the 52 employees in that branch speak multiple languages, including three of the managers. We have turnover and training issues. In the years 2000 through 2006, there were about 1,400 retirements within all of DHS. That alone represents about 42,000 years of experience lost. Another 27% of all CAF employees are eligible to retire within the next 5 years. We have about 1,100 caseworkers in CAF. Last year, 145 of those caseworkers left for one reason or another. It takes between 3 to 6 months to hire and train a new caseworker before they can work with their first client. So turnover is a huge issue for us. We have systems issues. Our current self-sufficiency computer system actually has more time on the job than I do. It was built as a payment system rather than a case management system and hasn't really functioned very well as a case management system. It's so old that when the year 2000 computer system issues came around, we literally had to contract for somebody to teach the language in which that computer system was written because it wasn't taught anymore. The good news is that we were able to patch the system and it made it through the Y2K issues. The bad news is that it made it through the Y2K issues, and we have a computer system that was literally designed in 72-73. It's still functioning. You will hear later in the DHS presentation from the Division of Administrative Services about a policy option package to help improve that aging computer system. Our child welfare computer system is also old and intractable, but fortunately we've approved funds for that to be improved and should be online in 2 to 3 years. In 1974, the work was primarily eligibility focused. Today, there's much more casework. When we were hired as welfare assistance workers, we were hired for our math skills rather than our people skills. And 32 years later, Ramona still reminds me I need to work on my people skills. Low grant amounts represent another challenge for our self-sufficiency workers. In 1974, the grant was 105% of the minimum wage and 98% of poverty. Today, the grant is 38% of a full-time minimum wage and 36% of poverty. In child welfare, in 1974, the typical drug-related issues that we faced were marijuana, LSD, sometimes heroin, not all that often heroin. Today it's methamphetamine, which is much more debilitating, addictive, and dangerous to children. And then, as now, every decision a caseworker makes to remove or leave a child in the home is distressing to someone, including the children. So these are very tough jobs, and I'm thankful that we have so many employees that are willing to take them on. And with that, I'd like to introduce Mercedes Lopez. She's been working with DHS for 16 years, worked in California with child welfare before that. And most of her time has been spent with us in protective services, though she has recently moved over to foster care certification. And you have testimony from Carolyn Pilar, been with DHS for about 7 years, started as an office specialist, and has become a case manager in the self-sufficiency area, working with survivors of domestic violence.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Lopez.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, everyone. Good afternoon. I work in the Gresham Child Welfare in the Certification Unit. And what my job is I assess families or relatives, friends for children when they come to the attention of the agency on an urgent basis. In the month of February, there were 15 requests to study relatives. And this process is very, very complex and very lengthy. It takes approximately 20 hours or more to complete a home study, depending on the case and the dynamics of the family, depending on what the needs of the family are, depends on the language, those kinds of variables. I want to share with you what happened this week. This was a week that I would call a tragic success. What happened this week was there was a 10-month-old boy. He was taken from his 17-year-old parents because they were heavily involved in gangs, and they were having some issues with law enforcement and making some poor choices. The tragic event that happened this Sunday was this little boy will be, on March 26, he'll be 1 year old. His 18-year-old father was killed. He either shot himself or was playing Russian roulette, and we don't quite know which one. But this is a really sad tragedy. But during the midst of this tragedy, some of the great things happened. One of the things that happened was we were able to come together as an agency and discuss this. We were able to discuss how we were going to help the family, how were we going to empower them, who would be making home visits, the safety of the child involved. And it was a wonderful opportunity because out of all of the community supports that are involved with this gang-related family, only child welfare made a home visit. We spent an hour and a half with the family, and we were able to let them know how much they meant to us and how appreciative we were that they were taking care of this child. It was incredible. They were just so grateful and so appreciative. And oftentimes, child welfare gets this really bad impression that they're just a terrible agency. But there's parts of child welfare that make it the best place in the world to be. And although this young man's death is going to affect us for quite a while, we've been able to communicate about this. It's unfortunate that it's a tragedy that gets us to this point where we can communicate and where we can share. We had great support from our community manager, John Richmond, and the various supervisors that were involved. It was just tremendous. This is a large family. There's lots of players in the family history. I'm involved because I've certified the grandparents to care for the infant. There's another infant on the way, so we're hoping that by being able to help them with this tragedy, we can make it better for the infant that's coming. Some more challenges are overtime. You've heard about that. But for us, it's a necessity. We often work overtime because our jobs are more than 60 hours a week. And some of us do want to have lives outside the office. And not only do we just have to do face-to-face contacts, but we also do other things, like put in case notes. And that's one of the reasons why we use SpeakRite. We participate in family decisions meetings. We return phone calls in a timely manner. We write letters. We also have to send families to resources, to community involvement, community places, and we do research for that to see what they qualify for. We participate in court hearings. We're the only agency that has to deal with all the animosity of everyone. Everyone doesn't like child welfare, except for when a tragedy happens. We have to work with a computer system that's not very user-friendly. We often can put things into the computer and then in an hour have it gone when we spend all morning trying to get it together. Wow. So we are working with these barriers, and we work very, very hard. And we work because we love families, we have a passion for children, and we want you to recognize that. We want you to recognize that we sometimes have silent worlds, like in certification and adoption. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to go into a home, to be intrusive, to go through every single room, every single closet, asking just many, many personal in questions so that we can ensure our children are safe. We're also the bridge to many of the social service specialists because we're the ears and we're the eyes that are in the home. We're the sounding board for the foster parents. We often come back and tell the workers and say, oh, did you know this was going on? Or did you know your young man was sick and had to go to the doctors and that he's had an ear infection for 3 days? Many times workers will say, no, I didn't know that. So in closing, some of our needs to be successful, we need available resources for our families, such as batterers intervention or drug or alcohol treatment. We need low-cost or free educational services for our family. Many of our families don't have a GED or are high school graduates. We need to empower them to get those diplomas and those certificates. We need daycare funds for our foster parents because many of our foster parents need to work. It's very expensive to live in today's society, as you all well know. We use our supports. Our SSAs are valuable. Programs such as SpeakRite are just invincible. We cannot do without them. I'm one of those that have just enjoyed it, and I find that it saves me a tremendous amount of time. We need adequate and continuous training for new employees, and not just like at the beginning when they first come in and they don't know anything. They go to training and they say, oh, I can do that. 6 months down the line, they go, oh, what was I supposed to do? I can't remember, because they're now doing it. We also need to have retention and supportive services, which I really respect that you're saying, because we have seasoned workers. We have workers like myself that have been there 16 years. It's a hard job. It gets harder every day. So we just really would like you to support us in that. And we would also like to have opportunities for advancement in child welfare, unless you want to be a supervisor, which some of us choose not to do. There's little or no options. We end up having to leave. And we always welcome anybody to come and job shadow, spend a day with us, spend an hour, come to a court hearing, a contested court hearing at that, and see what the workers go through. It's tremendous. It's mind-boggling. It's just I've been there, so I know. And I thank you so much for your time to listening to me.
I appreciate you so much being with us here today. I'm sure that the committee have some questions they want to ask. But if you'll just forgive me, I'm supposed to be auctioning off food for the governor's food drive, and they're waiting on me. That's why they came out. So if you forgive me as I depart, our vice chair will be in charge.
You better get a lot of money for that.
Okay.
You
questions?
Thank you very much.
I've got a thank you, too, for all you do. 16 years you've done that?
Yes.
That's amazing. I have a question for Ramona and maybe Jim. You've been here a long time, and you've been in the business a long time. Is there, when I hear your story, Mercedes, about this family, very young kids having kids, mm-hmm. and then the father has now died, and the young mother's on her own and having another child, and she's what, 18, 17?
She's 17.
She's still 17.
17.
Is there any effort on your part, once they become part of our system, to provide family planning, for example? Education about family planning, education, you know, having her get back into school if she's not in school. I heard you call for help in GED. I mean, she's clearly able, by age, to be educated in the state of Oregon. And why isn't that happening?
Well, we are trying to help her. She's just one of our mothers that's very resistant. And she's very involved in the gangs, which makes it extremely difficult. But one of the nicest things about that is we've had a very good partnership with the Gang Enforcement Task Force and Gresham. So together we're really trying to challenge this issue. We're hoping that she will hopefully make some life changes, that this will be an eye-opening experience for her. What's sad is the child that isn't going to know his dad. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, then you have some more offer here?
Vice Chair Boone, the one thing I was going to say is, yeah, often it's a matter of making those services available, and then families have to feel not threatened. They have to feel engaged. Getting a family engaged to receive services is really critical, as she says, because there's a matter of personal choice there. Again, most of the services we've talked about over the last several weeks are voluntary services. They're services that families come forth and access. Child welfare is the coercive service, and what you want to do is help that mom get her those kinds of services so that she doesn't end up having to have her child come into foster care. What you're being handed right now, and we wanted to give you this circles back around to the conversation around caseload growth, and this is the forecasting report that's put together by Judy Moore Peterson and her staff. And we won't have time to go into this today, but she does have her phone number, her fax number in there. If you look at this forecasting report and if you have questions, this kind of validates the issue that Mr. Navy was talking about earlier. That is kind of a leveling off on some of the caseloads. So that's what we wanted to be sure and leave with you all. I wanted to thank each of you all as committee members. You've been very attentive as we've done this CAF presentation. I know some of these programs might be new to some of you. Most of you, they're not new to, as I look around. But you've raised excellent questions. You've prompted us with really good suggestions and good questions, and we appreciate that very much.
Thank you very much, Mercedes. Thank you for taking the time to come in and share your stories with us. It's always good for us to hear from the front lines.
Thank you.
And thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
And also, Mr. Neely, thank you. My gosh, you could probably retire.
Don't say that to me.
I didn't want to. But thank you for your service, too. And thank you, Ramona, for all you've done.
Thank you.
Great presentation.
Thank you.
Is there any more business before the committee? We stand adjourned.